It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
I imagine, given the subject matter that I talk about on this program, that there are quite a few people in the audience that have played strategy and tactic wargaming type games on their computer or video console or what have you over the years. If that's a subject that interests you, I'm going to have an interview on this program where we talk to one of the founders of a company who makes the most up-to-date modern types of games, you know, with a historical theme and all that. I found by having the conversation with him that a lot of the same sorts of decisions and trade-offs and questions and quandaries came up in their development meetings that we had in the development meetings for War Remains, the virtual reality project I worked on. And that's at the World War I Museum in Kansas City, by the way, if you want to see that. So if you like that kind of stuff, a fascinating interview with Maximilian Ria, who's a game is Hell Let Loose, and it's a fascinating concept. So we'll talk to him a little bit later. It was, if there is a Ben's idea that we talk about. We sort of set up the context of that with a little personal stuff, which I don't like to do. And I told Ben, I said, who cares? It's not very interesting. And, you know, it's just me talking about my life. And Ben said, well, it's not very interesting. Whose fault is that? That's a hard one to have a pithy comeback for, isn't it? But the reason he brought it up is he said, you know, you talk about war games on the program all the time. You're going to be talking about something like that later in the program. Why don't you talk about, you know, war games as you knew them, kind of, or war games? Now, if this sounds like Grandpa Carlin on the front porch in the rocking chair, whittling, telling stories to the youngins and falling asleep about every 10 minutes, I apologize. The good old days, right? But it might be worth just bringing it up, because there's little things about wargaming that your general member of the general public doesn't know. I mean, one of the really seminal early rule sets for the wargaming genre that people played when I was growing up was written by H.G. Wells, the War of the Worlds author. Another thing a lot of people don't know is Wells actually wrote I know the modern version is in two volumes. I don't remember if the original was. I don't know if I've ever seen the original. He wrote a history of the world, too, from like caveman times to his era, which no matter how it turns out, think about what a task you set yourself there, right? My two-volume history of everything that's ever happened. You know how many podcasts we would have in that podcast series, given my long-windedness? But Robert Louis Stevenson, I guess, had an early set of rules. If you don't know the long history of war games, some of it has to be sort of imagined, because you can kind of infer that general staffs from militaries, you know, of the long lost past. I mean, the Assyrians had a general staff, right? Just like the German army had a general staff in the Second World War, with all the generals who would, you know, go over, they would war game by then, certainly. And one can imagine the great general staffs of all time trying to figure out, you know, tactics and strategy, maybe a little sand pit, maybe on a map, or what passed for a map. Then there are games that people argue about whether or not they should be classified as war games. Games like chess, which is, of course, very old. The Chinese game of Go, which is also very old, but without different battlefields and different terrain and random factors and all these kinds of things. People sometimes argue, although they're usually lumped in with the general wargaming sort of genre. I was reading something just for this discussion just now, and it was talking about the German version of this, because the modern history is always thought to begin, people will talk about Kriegsspiele, the German name for war game, because in the late 19th century, they were clearly playing a sort of mock battle, setting up battles that they were planning to have, and then working out all sorts of contingencies and approaches and trying stuff out. And I read, and I hadn't heard this before, maybe it's not true, how about that for a disclaimer? But that the French, there was an element in the in France that blamed that as a factor that led to their loss in the Franco-Prussian War. Now, I would think maybe railroad timetables and mobilization and all that might have had more to do with it. But it was an interesting thing to read, right? The secret weapon of the 19th century, you know, Prussians or early German state wargaming. I first was exposed to this, I guess you could say. My mom was doing some work, and we had to live. I mean, I have great memories of this, but I mean, had to live in London for several months. And I had my toy soldiers with me, because I'm about 1972, so I'm going to be 6 or 7. Always had the toy soldiers because for some reason from birth I'm into that stuff, and I have no explanation for why that might be. My mother's been trying to figure that out forever, and her theories border on the fantastic, right? Bermuda Triangle type stuff. But I always had the toy soldiers with me. And in London, I remember having them out on the floor one day, and a guy arrived. He may have been the son of one of my mom's guests or something, college student age. And he'd brought his soldiers because my mom had said, oh, you know, Dan's really into soldiers. And so he brought his own, went up to see me playing with mine, and sat down and said, you know, basically sat down, showed me his soldiers, and I was blown away because, you know, the difference between what you could have bought in a store, although what they sold in the store in those days was pretty damn fantastic. You didn't paint them yourself. They were called Britons Limited, I think. And they were so fantastic that I looked them up, and they still make them today. They're hand-painted. In those days, he had basically a whole army of hundreds of these things. Each single figure today sells for like $40 U.S., and you just sit there and go, holy cow, you got to be Elon Musk to have an army of these things today. 54 millimeters tall. But he pulls out these troops, and then he pulls out rules. And that was the part I'd never seen. That's the part that makes it a war game, right? Otherwise, you're playing toy soldiers. And he sat down. He started talking to the 6 or 7 year old version of me. And I didn't like this one bit, I can tell you right now. Because for me, it was all imagination and anything I wanted. And I didn't have to worry about anything. And this guy was basically giving me stuff like math to do. And lots of calculations and figuring out. I mean, just it ruined the spontaneity and the creativity of it all for me. But as you get older, you see the value in something like that, right? So fast forward to right around the era where Dungeons and Dragons started. So about 1976, I'm going from memory here. A rule set comes out called Chainmail. Chainmail actually came out in the very early 70s, I want to say like 1971, and I discovered all this stuff later. So when I say 1976, that's when I got into it. It happened to be written by two people, one of whom was Gary Gygax, who's probably the lead figure in Dungeons & Dragons. I think of other guys like Dave Arneson and whatnot, but Gary Gygax is sort of the lead D&D guy. And Dungeons & Dragons, I think, came out in 1974. Again, I discovered all this stuff in about 1976. Now, in the early Dungeons & Dragons rule sets, they didn't even tell you how to do certain things like how you would handle, you know, groups of people fighting other groups of people if there were large numbers. They would simply refer you in the rule set to chainmail. So you had to go pick up chainmail if you wanted to do those sorts of calculations. So I went out and got chainmail, which was my first exposure since London in the early 1970s to war games rules, right? Meant to be played with miniature figures. And I was older then and could appreciate and understand and all this sort of stuff. And so started experimenting with that. So then what you do is you realize, oh, I need to build an army, which was not that easy to do in the middle 1970s. You got to go find a place that sells this stuff. And the funny thing about it is this was a place, I believe, that Britain was way ahead of the United States. It was hard in the United States. There was a guy named Jack Scrooby who's famous in American war game circles who became one of these early people that started to just crank out figures for people, not because he wanted to make a lot of money, but because everybody needed figures or there was not going to be a hobby, right? You would gravitate towards places, and I don't know what you would do if you lived in some small town, but this is like New York and Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, places where they're almost like clubs. The people that ran these stores could not have been in it to get rich. But not only would they sell the materials, oftentimes they would have big tables in the back where people could come and fight battles and have, I mean, it became, these were little communities. I mean, if you were where I was from in the San Fernando Valley, 1970s, 1980s, you would have remembered places like Competitor's Castle with Skip Gardella. And I wonder what Skip's doing today. Hope he's okay. The Last Grenadier, Les Maisons de Guerre. Every community of large size had these places. And you didn't do a lot of cross-pollinating. I mean, I felt like it was almost a school or a fraternity or something like that where, you know, you had your place and then you meet up with all these other people at some convention down by the airport, you know, a couple of times a year, have big battles, competitions. The thing about wargaming with miniature figures, which is how I did it, that's different from what we have today, is there was a lot of elements to the hobby that you don't need with a computer game, but that I find that I like more than I thought I did. I mean, the painting of the figures. There's a railroad, you know, the model railroad side of this too, where people are building terrain and laying out battlefields. And I mean, there's many different creative elements involved in this before you even get to fighting it all out. Now, fighting it all out, I have to say, I don't miss that stuff at all. Let the computer handle the calculations. Let it automatically just take away what was a huge aspect of wargaming in miniatures back in the day, which is arguing, fighting over what a rule interpretation meant, or did you really move this way, or is this unit going to hit the forest and be disordered? I mean, nobody really liked that unless you were what was known as a rules lawyer, where part of the way you won was not your great tactical expertise, right? And you outthink the other guy. No, you just have these little rule things that you noticed, or maybe you know it backwards or forwards, or you have ways of basically arguing that you should get some sort of benefit that ends up leading to, well, if not a victory for the rules lawyer, then a less drastic defeat. I pulled out a bunch of my old books on the hobby, and some of them date from before my era. I went back and picked up some classics by people like Donald Featherstone, Joseph Morshauser, lots of stuff from Phil Barker, even in the modern era. Phil's still involved. I'm not sure, but I think he is. Tony Bath, people like that were the classics on the other side of the pond. And it was so clubby even then that when you would buy a set of rules, in the back it would be like, hey, you know, if you want to get a hold of us, here's our address. You can call us at this hour, but we might be gone during. I mean, it was so informal and clubbish that you felt like the guys that wrote this were just, you know, your buddy down the street. But that's how insular and small some of these things were. If you think about it, there's quite an entry level amount of stuff that's required to get into it. There's a barrier, right? I mean, this is not easy stuff to do. The time commitment alone is onerous. You have to be a bit of a fanatic. But I certainly was one of those people. And so when computer games first showed up, I was so excited. Because, I mean, this, you didn't need an opponent, you didn't need to spend all day if you didn't have a whole day. There were a lot of things that were very attractive about it. And even in the very early games, you could see, without being any kind of a technology expert, oh my God, give this 10 years, it's going to be in fabulously interesting places. Now, what's funny about me is the game that I play the most these days is a game that simply tries to replicate the miniatures version of the games that I played in the 1970s on a computer screen. I mean, graphically speaking, it's Stone Age. And everything moves just, I mean, it's hilarious because instead of having, there are more modern games where everyone moves sort of like individually and takes advantage of all the computer's power, and yet something in my, you know, maybe this is an elderly thing, you know, when you get nostalgic and you'd rather have the computer game play like Pong for you because you grew up with Pong. It brings back memories. One thing I should mention, and I only thought about this in preparation for this conversation, there was no blood. There was no violence, unless it was between two players arguing with each other. I mean, these games had miniature figures, whether it was in the pre-gunpowder era, which I often played, or the Second World War era, which I also played. And if somebody died, when you had casualties, you wrote it down on a piece of paper. You know, you do the math, you come up with your figures, you say, okay, you suffered 17 casualties in that charge. Okay, that doesn't even tell you how many are wounded versus how many are dead. You write it down on a piece of paper. Every time we got 20 or 25 casualties, you took a miniature figure off. That is the extent, though, of the connection between what you're doing and the violence that you're basically abstracting on the ground that would be there in the real-time situation. In the Second World War games we used to play, it was mostly vehicles. A tank would be hit. You'd say, that tank is destroyed. Maybe somebody creative puts a little puff of black cotton on it to represent smoke, and there you go. A little bit different, though, from some of the things you see nowadays, and that brings up interesting questions all its own, right? I mean, all of these developments, just like Dungeons and Dragons back in the old days, by the way, people forget how controversial that was for a time, always come with societal sort of quandaries that one can talk about. The difference between the violence involved in the war gaming I grew up with and some of the games today is significant. We'll talk a little about that in the upcoming conversation. In any case, I've had a long history with these sorts of games. I've never been the sort of guy, I think in my head, whatever Bermuda Triangle my mother thinks I sprang from, interested in this stuff from birth. I always wanted to be at like the Napoleon level of things, you know, in control of the battlefield, or like Hearts of Iron. The Hearts of Iron franchise basically makes you the head of the government, and you get to decide what sort of scientific experiments you want to take part in to develop, you know, things along. I mean, you get to be like a demigod. I like those levels, you know, surprise, surprise, rather than the Sergeant York, you know, on the battlefield with the squad sort of level. But the guest that I'm going to speak to in just a minute, Maximilian Ria, he's developed the kind of game where when I was playing the Pong version of war games on the very early personal computers, you could see in your mind's eye coming. And it's fascinating. The game in question is called Hell Let Loose, but it's part of a genre that many of you will have a lot of experience with. And there are all sorts of interesting questions that these games sort of prompt and have connected to them. And those are the sorts of things we're going to talk about right now. With me right now is Maximilian Ria. He is one of the founders and also the project director and art director over at Black Matter Studios, the developers of Hell Let Loose. Tell me a little bit about your game here so that the public understands just how far things have gone in terms of development in the wargaming space.
Sure thing. So our game, Hell Let Loose, pits 50 players versus 50 other human players, so 100 human players in total, against each other in combat on a World War II battlefield that we've sort of recreated from lots of satellite imagery to map out the landscape, and then copious amounts of reference photography and aerial photography. And basically these two forces, so initially it's US forces versus German forces, fight over this piece of land, much like they did in World War II, using the iconic weaponry of the day and the vehicles of the day. And we've kind of tried to match that as much as possible to the historical record with some flex where we need it, just due to the nature of games as a medium. But that's kind of where we're at now, in so much as video games are concerned, as a digital art form.
So in terms of what people's expectations are, right? So everything is built on top of what came before. Is this a new level? Because, you know, you had sent me a screenshot of a particular defensive position, Pavlov's house at the Battle of Stalingrad, and were talking to me about how until you actually saw it portrayed and rendered in a form that made it visual and three-dimensional, you didn't even realize how tough a position this was. I can remember first-person shooter games. I didn't play them, but I remember the graphics and stuff way back in the mid-1990s. How much of a step up is this in terms of a faithful rendering of what people at the time would have seen in that place and in that sphere?
So I think something that kind of modern computing power is enabling us to do is, I mean, first of all, video games are always representative. They're always symbolic of obviously something that's happening. We can never quite capture the full historical reality of any conflict. I mean, mainly because it might not be something that players would be willing to put their time into playing. You know, a lot of combat, as we both know, was huge amounts of waiting around or doing very, very menial, difficult tasks. However, where we are able to symbolize things, what modern computing power lets us do is represent them at a larger scale. So, for instance, as you said, Dan, Pavlov's house, this famous Soviet apartment building in Stalingrad, previously when it's been portrayed in games, it's been being portrayed at a compressed size, almost everything at half or a third scale. And something that we've done in our particular game is just with modern computing power has enabled us to render this at the actual real scale that it is in real life, including sort of measurements for the apartment building and the square. So I think what modern computing power is enabling us to do is increase the size of our representation of these historic conflicts. And obviously, Something else that's quite novel and is becoming, you know, is growing by really the year is the player count. Modern networking power, the amount of information you can send over the internet is increasing as players get better access to better internet. And the systems also become more sophisticated. And so something we were quite quick on was doing 100 players. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot of players, a lot of soldiers on a battlefield, and it isn't. But it's a step up from 64, and 64 was a step up from 32, and 32 was a step up from 16, and 16 was obviously a step up from only being single player, that is, not playing with other players around the world. And so what we're kind of looking into the future at is the scale just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And obviously then the mind starts to wonder about how big could you go, and what would that representation be like of you know, of these different battles and just broader experiences generally.
So other than the increasing number of players that can be incorporated into a game, what sort of feedback are you getting from users in terms of what they like and what they'd like to see more of? In other words, when they give you a wish list for the next version, what are they asking for?
I think it's always a mixture. It always depends on the player. But I think for our title, or at least any title trying to capture historical reality or what people's idea of historical reality is, it's always to expand it, to offer more fronts, more battlefields. But then it's obviously also to deepen the fidelity. And what that can mean is it could mean having realistic flamethrowers that project liquid fuel in the same way they did on the battlefield. Or it might mean very, very complex simulations of armor penetration and the way that different rounds and projectiles struck different armor platings and thicknesses. That's sort of where we're being pushed within our kind of subgenre of this sort of hardcore military historical shooter. But obviously across gaming, we're expanding out in many, many different ways. And obviously, you know, very exciting, and obviously also with some trepidation as well.
Well, let's talk about that part of it, because as a guy who's been wargaming since the early 1970s, there's an abstraction to the traditional wargaming that sort of does away with the very thing that is the focus of the fidelity first-person shooter games. I mean, when I'm playing a tank battle in the 1970s, I might have 30 or 40 figures representing tanks, but there's no real human beings there. There's no one burning up. There's when a tank destroys another tank, it's almost as though it's an inanimate object. You're playing a form of chess, kind of, that divorces you from, you know, it's strategy and tactics more than there's any sense of realism. It seems to me that it is both the attraction and also, like you said, sort of the dicey, interesting moral quandary area where the fidelity of the game, especially at the ground level, creates challenges. And listen, this has nothing to do specifically with your game. I mean, this goes since first-person shooters started. It's been a question of how much of this is all of the fun and adrenaline and action with none of the consequences. But for example, here's the problem I have with this, and that's that I don't do this personally, so it's hard for me to put myself in the shoes of what people get out of this. But this is a hugely and fabulously lucrative area of video games. People love doing this, whether they're shooting at zombies or trolls or vampires or other people. How do you as a designer walk this fine line between something that is intended to be both fun and potentially teach people about history and make them understand better what people were dealing with historically versus simply the enjoyment that comes with shooting another human being in a virtual world and watching their head explode?
Look, I think it's a
That's a very I started to make the question so damn long.
No, I know, and I think it's a fantastic question, and I think it needs, you know, and in return it needs a relatively detailed answer. And I think for better or worse, what we're doing with video games is largely what we've done with wargaming, in so much as I sort of touched on, we know that everything is representative, everything is symbolic. Now, obviously, we are getting far closer Within our symbolism, in so much as within our game, for instance, and many other games, obviously, first-person shooters, the entire game loop, which is sort of what we call the experience that you're repeating in the game over and over and over again. So sort of dribbling the ball and putting it in the goal and in football and in soccer would be the gameplay loop of soccer. In our gameplay loop, you are using a gun, depending on what role you play, to shoot another, you know, another represented human with the aim of taking a position in order to win the game, taking a trench network or taking an artillery position. The thing is, though, it is representative in so much as all the players within the game know that failure means that they are to respawn, so come back into the game further back from the front line. The way that we sort of represent this is that the player over the course of a game is representing many, many a weight of number than just themselves. And fundamentally, the kind of end game conversations that you have in a game like ours and other first-person shooters doesn't actually touch on the idea of or the joy of the actual shooting another person. And what it largely focuses on, and I would almost say in the majority, is the tactics and the strategy, much like wargaming, in achieving a success over the enemy in the broader context of the battle. So in the same way that with wargaming, you might move a panzer unit into position in a way that your opponent didn't expect, and you're able to defeat the opposing formation or the opposing unit, we're doing a very, very similar thing. That's sort of the hook to the player on the ground level in the game. So I think, look, I don't want to give a mealy-mouthed answer, but I think that the more that I've thought about it, the more we're trying to set up these sort of strategic and tactical questions in the game. And obviously in doing so at an infantry level, and within an individualistic way for players who choose to play on kind of as kind of frontline infantry roles, that does involve obviously firing a weapon and firing it in anger at an enemy human target. However, I would say that it is, and it sounds funny to say this, but a very small part of and I'd almost argue almost an insignificant part of what makes this genre tick. And I think you can kind of see that in other first-person shooter genres where you may not even, you know, shooting a player may not even result in their death. The way it's represented on screen won't be that, you know, them blood pouring out and shot and falling over. It'll just be their removal from the battlefield for them to come back later. So much more of a sort of a very obviously gamified version. So I think that's kind of the thing. In so much as players don't have much of an attention span if the sole object, the sole pleasure, the sole purpose is just to try and experience that visceral idea of killing someone. I think it's far more about the strategical and tactical maneuvering that sees sort of long-term victory. I mean, that's the best sort of explanation I can give of the genre, because I understand from the outset, looking at it, it is, you know, it seems like that is the sole object. Whereas I think the thing that hooks most players is that greater strategic and tactical layer. And that's certainly what we see in sort of the communities of people who follow these games. A lot of the conversation does drill down to very, very, very esoteric topics like, you know, the gear speed of particular vehicles, enabling them to get to a certain point of the battlefield faster than the other people, that sort of thing, and less on the designed experience of simulated killing of the enemy, if that makes sense.
It does, because a lot of that follows from the earlier war games we used to play, where you would talk about tank specifications and speeds and turning radiuses and how quickly the turret would move, things like, so I totally get all that. I can't decide, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, because I've been swaying back and forth, and I've certainly not thought about it for one bazillionth of the amount of time I'm sure you've thought about it. I can't decide how I feel about the fidelity of the human damage, right? So when a gun or a grenade or anything does damage to a human being in the game, a virtual human being, I can't decide if you want to make it more graphic because that actually helps bring a reality into this that makes people think. In other words, the more graphic you make it, the more you go, oh, this is a really nasty thing to get hit with. I wouldn't want to be involved with this in real life. Or I sometimes go to the other extreme where I'm thinking, okay, the bigger the splat of red ink that layers on the ground, the more I'm getting a kick out of that. How do we deal with the fidelity question and the way that that impacts the player? I mean, one could argue, I think, that the more brutal you make it, the more you help compensate for some of these other things we've been talking about. The other side of it is the more brutal you make it, maybe more of a kick the people who like that are getting out of it. How do you guys measure that when you're trying to design this thing and they're talking about representations, for example, of what a grenade does if it explodes in your midsection and whatnot? I mean, it's got to be an interesting fly on the wall sort of moment in the room when you guys are designing these things.
It definitely is. I mean, I think, and interestingly, I think it actually comes down to sort of your philosophy about the preservation of history. Which I don't want to give a sort of politician's answer, but for us, the way that we've approached this is that we're trying to, as best as possible, display to you the best of our knowledge, what would happen in real life in kind of nearly every instance of what you encounter in the game. When you're making any piece of media, and video games obviously being no exception, you're always making decisions about what you include because sort of nothing's there existing before you start. So we have to build all the systems. We have to build, you know, create all the character models, all of our soldiers. We have to create even the look of the dirt on the ground and the way the trees sway and everything like that. And I think you reach this really interesting conundrum, as you have touched on, where historically, and I think depiction of the German forces, Nazism, things like that, very, very contentious and extremely difficult topics can be approached in many different ways. And I think something we've tried to do is to present the recorded history without softening or doing anyone any favors by deciding to curate in a particular way, one way or another. And what I mean by that is we don't want to soften the violence of war because we feel that it would do a disrespect to the memories of those people who fought and died. And we don't want to, obviously don't want to encourage killing either, but we felt that it's very important to depict here what happened when these people were given this weaponry and they fought each other as a way, I think, of preserving this. I mean, and you see this done in films, which obviously have a much stronger narrative presence and have a much greater ability to kind of inform your moral take on the events that are unfolding. And obviously video games have a harder time with that because if you're making a multiplayer game as we are, it becomes extremely difficult to have any narrative voice. There's simply no part in the game. Just as you would be watching a game of football, really you would need a commentator to give color to and story to the actions unfolding on the screen in a way that lets you morally connect with it and not just understand the plays as they were happening. So it's extremely fraught. And the way that we've approached this attempt at preserving history is to do justice to the violence of war, the violence of this conflict, to not reward it. But then also we do know that there is some element of people's reaction that is out of our control. I mean, that's a caveat. But what we've found with our community and the people who play the game is that conversations about the violence within the game are actually almost the last thing they comment on. And more what takes center stage is an appreciation of the The minutiae and the detail on different weapons and different uniforms and vehicles, the layout of maps and things like that. So it's an extremely fraught topic. It's extremely difficult. But I think for us, our perspective of the history is to present it as it was and then let the players decide whether this is horrendous or whatever, and not try and soften it for them. Because we feel that the violence of this needs to be understood. I think in the same way that someone like Spielberg made very, very concerted decisions within his portrayal in Saving Private Ryan of the violence of war to show the human impact on the impact of the violence on the civilian population of France in that really heartbreaking scene where Vin Diesel's character is shot by the German sniper. And then also, we also see the returning fire on the German sniper as well. And I think that, you know, it was interesting that Spielberg decided to show the horrendousness of that to the audience. So that's sort of our approach to this. You know, it may not be a perfect one, but we are really approaching it in good faith from an historical perspective. And trying not to curate away from the nastier side of it.
Well, it's interesting. You went right where I was going to go, to the Spielberg type stuff, because I was see, and that's a perfect example of the artistic trade-offs, because it was always my contention, because that movie garnered such attention when it first came out for being so realistic, and my critique was that it wasn't realistic enough, and the fact that the media thought that was what war looked like when it was realistic was an example right there that it didn't have a real idea of what real war was like. And so I thought it should have been more vicious, more graphic, and the whole thing. And yet Spielberg, in the same way, you know, we did a virtual reality First World War exhibit. I did it with a bunch of other people, and we had these meetings where we had the same kinds of questions coming up, which is, do you really want to make it as graphic and horrible as it was? And if you did, would anybody go to take part in it? If Spielberg shows you what war really looks like, does anybody go to the movie? Right? Or does it get an X rating so nobody can go to the movie? I also want to point out that your game is part of a long history of a genre that people are very comfortable with right now. So you shouldn't have to answer all these basic questions about first-person shooter things. I'm interested in the idea, though, of taking this to the next level. And one of the things that your game does is push the boundaries of realism, the feeling of a three-dimensional space where you're cooperating with other people. I mean, there's elements in this which are new, I would think. Am I right in saying that? Would you say that this game pushes certain boundaries in terms of directions in the genre?
Yeah, I think it does, definitely. But I'd say, you know, like everyone, we're always standing on the shoulders of giants and the people who came before us. And I think in the context of video gaming, I mean, video games, blow the trumpet of the video game industry for a moment, is an art form.
Absolutely.
And it's a very young art form as well. I mean, it's only really existed, you could argue, sort of for 40 or 50 years at best, at a big stretch, and only really becoming popular to a sort of majoritarian context, I think, in the last 10 to 15 years. It certainly changed hugely from when I was young to now, the number of people who play them and engage with them. And like all art forms, I think that it's always evolving on itself. It's always trying to develop on itself. And I think we're one in a long line of people who have been doing that. But you're definitely right in so much as I think we're evolving towards teamwork. I think our game in particular is appealing more towards an older player base, one who's not just interested in being very, very good at aiming, but is also really interested in communication, in community itself, in working with larger and larger groups of players and coordinating and finding success in that coordination. And I think we're kind of seeing this across the whole video game genre. Games that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you would think were completely commercially non-viable, I would argue we would be in that category as well, have started to take a greater portion of the market, an ever-growing market. And it's been very, very interesting to kind of see that happen. And it's very, very interesting also to think about the future and where it might go. And I think the best guess anyone has is to look at what we have now and just to imagine what happens if it gets bigger and pushes further in that direction, pushes further in the direction of teamwork, pushes further in the direction of scale, strategy, planning. And that's just for our genre. You know, I think that the same can be said of every genre within video gaming, that it will find new ways to iterate on itself. I mean, virtual reality alone, I think, is going to have an extremely significant impact. I mean, dare I say it, on humanity, once they solve sort of the issues around getting one into every household. I think that's going to be extremely interesting to see where it goes. So yeah, the video game genre just seems to continue to iterate at an absolutely breakneck pace. And so something, I guess, that we were doing that was new, you know, now may no longer be new as of you know, a year ago, a week ago, a day ago.
So I brought up some of the traditional and maybe almost stereotypical downsides of the genre, but let's talk about some of the upsides. Wargaming was something that helped deepen and amplified and accelerated my enjoyment and interest in history. I can only imagine, and you're going to know so much more about this than I can only imagine the same effect that this is having with young people coming up today who might never think of cracking a book or going down and doing any research themselves on history until something like this prompted the spark in them of interest. Do you see this as, I mean, if old-fashioned wargaming with miniature figures that you hand-painted yourself could have that effect on me, do you think that this is something that becomes an introductory path for people to become more interested in the period being displayed and that they're learning about as they go through these things?
Definitely. I mean, this is actually something extremely close to home for me. So during the 90s, the early 90s, when I was growing up, my father would spend nights relaxing after he got home from work by painting little figurines of the Scots Grey Cavalry at Waterloo. And he had basically a tabletop of Waterloo set up. And I would watch him paint these small figurines. And I don't think he ever got around to actually wargaming them. He just really enjoyed the catharsis of painting these tiny miniatures. And from there, he then, you know, sort of Age of Empires, I think, came out in 1997 or 1998. Age of Empires was really one of the first sort of very accessible historical games. It was an extremely vibrant game. It told the story of Genghis Khan, of Joan of Arc, his name escapes me, the Holy Roman Emperor. I'm not doing a very good job of it right now, but
Charlemagne.
But this game, my dad showed me this game, and he took an interest in it, obviously, because of his love of history. And he introduced me to this game, and this game introduced me to the stories of these extremely iconic but very dispersed historical figures. And I would have been only kind of 8, 9, or 10, and it just gripped me entirely. And so it's an interesting microcosm of my dad going from wargaming, or at least painting and appreciating all the miniatures, to video games, and then that being directly given to me. And I also should say that, you know, he still paints these figurines to this day, and I love working with him on them. And I myself have done some wargaming. I was a big sort of Warhammer fan as well. And so it is interesting how that sort of transmitted through. And then from Age of Empires, I learned the stories of these key figures, some better than others, as we both know, with regards to Charlemagne. But I then started playing other historical games. And that's actually the first person shooter game I started playing was a game called Battlefield 1942, obviously a World War II game, not dissimilar to our own. And then Call of Duty, which was a World War II game as well. And in those games, I just picked up this extreme interest in World War II as a period, as an historical period, and all the interesting things that took place within it, obviously, and all the tragedy within it as well. But it was this direct transmission from wargaming to video gaming. And then A lot of that has then shaped and directly inspired what we've done at my company with our game. And it's also inspired the way that we try and capture these events as well, because just as I learned something, you know, approximating the historical record through the games that came before, I'd like to kind of pay that service to the people who end up engaging with our game. So I definitely think there's a direct transmission through there. And I think as well, you know, we're seeing war movies and historical movies particularly take a backseat to other genres of films. I think the superhero genre has sort of become the new war movie genre, if you like. And there's obviously exceptions to that rule, but I think more and more so now, young people especially are engaging with history through games. And so we see ourselves as in a small way able to contribute to some kind of understanding of these conflicts.
Well, first of all, I must be closer to your dad's age, because I also have thousands of those miniature figures that I painted myself from the old days that I still have. I also remember the very first computer I ever bought, I bought for only one reason, and that was there was a game called The Ancient Art of War that I had to play, and we're talking about the mid-1980s here. So as a guy who had been in the, let's call it the analog world of wargaming, the potential to take that into the realm of computer games was absolutely, probably the first 15 computer games I ever owned were all war games or variations of war games. And in fact, one of my favorite ones to play right now, the Field of Glory games, are all nothing more than an attempt by somebody who certainly played those same games with miniature figures like I did to take that game and turn it into an actual computer game where you don't need to worry about finding opponents. As you know from your dad's experience, the hobby itself is it's a hardcore hobby in the sense that there's almost an obsession to it. And if you're a young person, it's an extremely expensive hobby to break into. The entry level requirements are huge, whereas with a computer game, it is maybe under the Christmas tree, you can have it there. And then all of a sudden, without any more investment than that, you can become somebody who's learning about the past through an immersive sort of an experience. So, I mean, I definitely do see the similarities. Can you talk to me a little bit, not shifting gears here, but I'm interested in the game and trying to figure out how you deal with, the Second World War is famously more of a good guy, bad guy war. If you go to the First World War, you can do a much better, I think, example where anybody could potentially be the good guys, depending on the point of view you have. How does one incorporate, especially since, as you said, you lack the ability to incorporate a heavy-duty narrative to the whole thing? I mean, I guess I'm just thinking I would not be the kind of guy to play the German forces just because of my own inherent biases. How does that, I mean, and if you're doing Stalingrad, some might make a case, and I think we did in a podcast once, that from the American or the British point of view, both those sides are necessarily fraught with, what's the word I'm looking for here, moral quandaries might be a good way to put it. And I know that in Germany, you can't show things like swastikas and all that. How does one navigate the difficult terrain of the morality in a war that is so dominated by the moral questions?
That is, that's the key question in so much as us coming to this subject matter. It is certainly difficult, and it's certainly one that we constantly think deeply about. And obviously, I mean, so at a baseline, we have removed all of the Nazi iconography within the game. That means obscuring swastikas and other imagery like that on uniforms and things. So we have this incredibly difficult balance of trying to give these soldiers the actual uniform they fought in, which often is not what you would think it would look like. I think everyone has an opinion of German soldiers as wearing a red armband, obviously, you know, almost like a ceremonial outfit. But a lot of them were wearing, you know, sort of the equivalent of a wool jacket, some pretty rough boots, and obviously wool pants. But nevertheless, we're trying to portray them as they were, ideally within the theater that they were fighting. And as accurately as possible, while also making sure that we don't, you know, obviously we abide by German law, and then just out of sensitivity, also obscure the swastika more generally. We've also currently made the decision that we won't be including the ability to dress as the SS in the game, which you would think would be a very easy decision to make. But for a lot of sort of the historical purists, people get into all sorts of different difficult conversations about, oh, well, what do you do about the NKVD? You know, obviously Stalin's secret police.
As you said, they
themselves did not have clean hands. And then obviously you then have another portion of people who might say, okay, they agree that both the Nazis and some elements of the Soviet forces engaged in this stuff, but what about the British in this location or the Americans in this location or so on and so forth. So it does become an extremely, again, a very difficult kind of landscape to maneuver through. We try to do it with sensitivity by obviously removing specific imagery alongside also wanting to do that to comply with German law. I think we've avoided thus far including other types of imagery, the hammer and sickle and things like that. When it comes to the actual infield, the on the battlefield type experience, I mean, no part of the game is set up to enable you to do anything other than just sort of play the game against another force. We don't have any civilians on the battlefield. We don't have anything that could add or give players, you know, an opportunity to, you know, questionable elements, let's just say. We're just very keen to focus you on the frontline combat experience of those soldiers. I think the kind of conundrum we've had is that if you didn't want to portray any morally questionable people, I mean, morally questionable people within war, you really can't portray it at all. And I don't want to give a sort of cop-out answer there, but I mean...
No, I actually agree. I agree with that, actually.
Yeah, and so obviously, well, okay, so if we either can't portray it at all or we can portray it, then how sensitively do we try to portray it? And for us, it's, as I kind of touched on earlier, it's really about the strategic and tactical competitive elements of this, rather than any of the ideology associated with it. It's not present anywhere in the game. I think the strongest thing that we've got in the game is some of the writing on the wall, the graffiti that some of the Soviet soldiers wrote in Stalingrad that was sort of denouncing fascists. I think that's about as political as we've got in the game. And that was largely as set dressing because it was so iconic within Stalingrad. You just saw tons of posters everywhere and tons of graffiti everywhere of these soldiers trading insults back and forth. And I think that's kind of as close as we've got to depicting anything, especially ideological within the game. Obviously, one could argue that depicting them at all is ideological. But as we've said, you would then create a situation where you really could never depict historical events to some degree. I think it becomes very difficult.
I'm of two minds about this, though, and it's the same thing with the violence. I think and I haven't thought about it anywhere near as long as you have, but the same side of me that suggests that maybe uber violence is and treating this as realistic as possible helps eliminate some of the downside. I feel the same way about, like, when we would have World War II, Second World War is always the way I phrase it. When we were having Second World War tank battles back in the 1970s, I guarantee you people painted swastikas on the top of their tanks for aircraft recognition, as was done. And so there's a part of me that thinks that, and I understand from a corporate standpoint and German law and all those other things, you have really no choice, but there's a part of me that thinks that perhaps... And I can go both ways, because most people, you could say, would not be affected negatively by incorporating hammer and sickles or swastikas or all those things. But the same small group of people that might be negatively affected by being able to go around shooting other virtual human beings might be affected by having swastikas and playing the SS. And all. But I don't know if you can create whole game systems based on what 2 or 3 or 4% of the users might react to. You know, in opposition to the way everybody else reacts, I think most people would be fine with all those other things. And I think it might be a more faithful example of history. I mean, to incorporate a Nazi German army and not show swastika seems weird, right? I mean, I understand why it doesn't happen, but there's a part of you that goes, well, if we're trying to teach about the war, and if we're trying to make this an introduction to a fascinating period in human history, which involves some of these extreme ideologies, if you take the extreme ideologies out, haven't you left this giant black hole that is a huge part of the reason that this fighting is happening to begin with? I mean, it is a really tough thing, and I remember having similar discussions when it came to the immersive virtual reality experience connected to realism, whereas as a certain point, it becomes, how do you create a faithful reproduction of a negative human experience, but not so much that it turns people off from wanting to participate in it? And so I think there's this fine line you guys have to walk, and then you add the corporate thing, and then you add the German law kind of thing. But it does seem like there would be something inherently missing in what is an ideological war. If you take out the ideology, it seems like you guys would have to design around. I guess I'm having a real admiration for your ability to design around those issues.
Yeah, it is. You're 100% correct, though, in so much as if we are trying to portray things as best we can according to the historical record. I mean, I come at it in two minds, and I'm sure you do the same. And I mean, you've already just said that you do. The swastika is, I would argue, one of the most powerful icons in human history, at least modern human history. Nearly everyone in the world knows what that symbol means and the suffering it caused. And the suffering that it continues to cause. I mean, and the echoes of it through history. And so to show it is to show it will evoke a response either way. And I'd be concerned if someone didn't have a response to seeing it. And the same can be said for other symbols, of course. But the swastika is a uniquely or a near uniquely powerful one. Within the time and history that we find ourselves. From our perspective, the way that we've sort of felt about it is that our purpose as the type of game that we are, we're not a single player game, we're unable to tell story, we're unable to guide the player through narrative, means that we don't have the ability to kind of give it the proper context that we think it needs. And as a result, we are happy to slightly, to obscure it within our game, because we are focused at the end of the day. The object of the game is to maneuver across the battlefield using all the weaponry in the same uniforms, both Allied and Axis forces, in order to achieve a tactical strategic victory over the other force. And so we felt that, this isn't if we're not going to attempt to tell the story at all, then we're best to err on the side of caution. And maybe we might be wrong in that, and I'm sure as well that many people will know that there's always a line where you can draw that. I mean, you could say, well, why have them dressed up as German soldiers at all? Or there's always a line, and that is 100%, I think, subjective. There's no objective rule to this. And that's extremely tough for us because boy, oh boy, would life be easier if there was an objective rule. But it is subjective, and it's kind of the approach that we've taken, is that if our object is not to tell the full story of this, of this conflict ideologically, then I think we're better to err on the side of caution with this.
How does the user base feel? I mean, it's one thing for the people in the corporate side of things to worry about all these things, because that's your job. But the people who are only concerned with either the fun element or the competitive element or the historical element or all of those wrapped up together, who give you the feedback on things you can change or things they're not happy with or what should be in the next version, do they have an opinion one way or the other? I'm sure swastikas and hammers and sickles and all those kinds of things have been raised before. Is there an opinion out there one way or the other from them?
I wouldn't say there's a majority opinion. I would actually say that the more historically oriented people, I should say, or the purists within our particular community, tend to focus much more on battlefield history rather than sort of ideological history. There are some people, I would say it's probably less than 1%, who would really like to see. It's very important to them that you capture the full. You capture the full picture with the inclusion of swastikas or the SS. But I would say actually that more of the historical feedback that we get is more around some of the concessions we've had to make due to it being a video game rather than any kind of ideological censorship. So the things that they're concerned with are more like, exactly as you said, the turret rotation speed on particular tanks. They're concerned about within our game, we've had a preponderance of automatic weapons. We've had probably a few too many automatic weapons on the side of the Germans at the unit level, which they would love us to kind of dial back. And we're going to make a move to dial back and keep it more focused around the Kar-98K, which is the German bolt action rifle, which was the weapon the majority of soldiers used. So a lot of the sort of historical oriented criticism, I think, comes down to more of the battlefield and the strategic and the tactical elements rather than anything kind of ideological, which is interesting. But I suppose now that I think about it, suiting to what we're actually trying to capture as an end outcome.
What's interesting is you wouldn't have any of these problems in the majority of conflicts in human history. It's the nature of the Second World War and maybe some of the conflicts during the Cold War that happened after that. Those are the only ones I can think of that would give you any trouble at all. I mean, if you're going back to Genghis Khan's conquest, none of this enters into the equation at all. So you're actually getting trapped in the creases of the leftover, you know, ideological and moral fumes of that conflict itself, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, and you know, I never want to be insensitive. I mean, in so much as you're right, like there aren't a lot of I think it was ancient Mesopotamia or the location of modern day Iraq that Genghis Khan sacked.
He sacked a lot of places.
He sacked a lot of places. Yeah, true. He was. If there was one thing he was very good at, it was death and destruction. But no, I think you're right. I think it's the proximity to this, and I think also, I mean, even just in diving so much into the history, we've really been so saturated in World War II history. There is something unique about the forces at play. I mean, all of them are ideologically very different. Roughly sort of capitalist, communist, fascist. There's just something extremely, not outlandish, but eccentric about them, and particularly the German forces naming their vehicles after sort of predatory animals. It just the fact that this terrifying tank was called the Tiger Tank, whereas sort of the Americans obviously named them after generals. There were these decisions that heightened that ideological difference. And then obviously, you know, the extremity of the Nazi ideology and the extremity, obviously, you look at sort of Holodomor and the famines within Soviet Russia. And it's just such a huge scale of human suffering. And it's such a recent event, really, relative, obviously, to Khan. That I think, yeah, we are. There's still, you know, sensitivity is required to handle these issues. But you're right. I mean, I think obviously people will have political differences about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam and depicting a Vietnam War conflict, but far, far, far less fraught and far, far, far less clear cut on the surface than obviously World War II. It's a tough one. It's an extremely tough one. And obviously all war to some degree, and the way that we view them is written by the victors. But I think it's very difficult to say that, it's very difficult to inject more nuance into a conversation about World War II.
I think some people might say that those very questions are what makes it so compelling. So I think that it's all wrapped up into this package that is the Second World War, and the fact that I had somebody say to me that they thought that the Second World War was more interesting than the First World War, specifically because of the ideological questions that we were just discussing. So before I let you go, what I'd like to know, just as a guy who's an expert in the field, I remember playing the Ancient Art of War in the 1980s, and the difference between that and what you're putting out is it's not one generation, it's multi-generations. Where do you see this going in like 10 years, 15 years? Any clues on what lies around the development bend?
Look, this is I wouldn't say it's a $1 million question. It's probably a $1 trillion question for the industry. And I think that, you know, depending on your outlook, it's either utopian or dystopian to some degree. And obviously the truth nearly always lies somewhere in the middle. I think that we'll start to see virtual reality come into play, as I said earlier, if they solve sort of the delivery issue, the ability for people to play it without having to pay a huge amount of money. We will very quickly start to see people playing our type of game in virtual in VR space, in 3D, moving your body around, actually having to hold a weapon up. I mean, I think more generally and more broadly, video games is in an explosion of growth at the moment, because we're seeing a generation that grew up with them age through the population. So obviously, you know, many generations currently never ever had games when they were younger. And we're seeing this, we're seeing what it looks like for the first time, for instance, for, you know, people of all ages, for instance, to read books, you know, in so much as there was a time a long time ago where books were the new thing or television was a new thing or film was the new thing. And what we're seeing with video games is an advancing generation of people who grew up with them. And so I think that it's only going to get bigger. But I also think that it places huge, you know, burden of responsibility on people making these sort of digital environments to safeguard or try and build systems that people enjoy, that don't exploit them, that don't, you know, trying to present the best form of entertainment that we can in as ethical a way as we can, and try and figure out what that looks like when more and more people's time is spent in these digital environments. So I know that sounds sort of very kind of doomsaying if you think about it from the perspective of everyone spending tons and tons of hours playing video games. But I also think that, you know, video games have amazing potential to connect people who might be struggling, you know, perhaps to make friends in their physical surroundings. People connect with each other online. They share great memories online. They get to know each other more and more and more. We're seeing virtual reality experiences enable people to exercise within VR. You know, it's not uncommon now for people to meet their future husband or wife or partner online in games. So it is extremely varied, and I think it's all moving faster than anyone can really keep up with. But I definitely think that VR is probably the place to watch, because if anyone's ever tried that, it's quite an experience, and it can often trick you psychologically. Your eyes can kind of deceive you, obviously, and it'll be very, very interesting to see what kind of experiences move into VR, whether, you know, it's shooting games or whether it's strategy games. I mean, it'll be all of them, but which really pick up with the players. So look, yeah, it's a big road ahead, and I just you know, I'll be working, and I think many people will to try and make it the best experience possible, whatever that looks like.
I think this blends nicely into the overall question of the development of war games in the modern era. And if you could have told me in the mid-1970s that someday this would be... I mean, like I said, I went and bought a computer just so I could play a game that looks like it's tic-tac-toe compared to the games out there now. So I appreciate you taking the time to answer these really tough questions and to bring us sort of into the development room a little bit and help us understand the kinds of things that you guys were talking over. And I can speak from experience that was the exact same kinds of conversations we had designing the first World War game, is these trade-offs, these morally ambiguous areas, how you portray negative things, and how faithful you have to be to stuff so that you're not giving a fake or imprecise or something that's a fantasy of a reality, if that makes sense. Showing something that's actually a fantasy game portraying itself as history, and I think trying to get it right is actually the key to the whole thing. The one thing we didn't talk about, and that's worth just bringing up here at the very end, is the interplay between all of the other people. One of the things you'd mentioned to me was the fact that a lot of people in this game are actually not tip of the spear people, but you're actually showing how many people are involved in keeping the logistics going and all the, and that, you know, you'd mentioned teamwork, and I think that conjures up this idea of, okay, I'll go around this hill, you go around this other side, but you've actually got people sort of operating in the supply chain too, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. I mean, I think as I sort of said a little bit earlier about this sort of aging generation of gamers, I mean, myself being right there, you know, when you're younger, you're extremely good at, you know, twitch mechanics of your twitch fibers. The muscles enable you to track things with your hand-to-eye coordination at incredible rates. And so a lot of video games, you know, were thought to be sort of the fare of just of young people, and then you sort of grow out of them. And what we've kind of seen is that as gamers have aged, the types of things that stimulate us and interest us sort of age with us, obviously, which seems obvious now, but I don't think it has been really. And so as a result of this, you've started to see an uptick in games like ours, in so much as we move the experience away from just the hand-to-eye coordination, the success of that, to sort of strategy, planning, talking to one another, communicating, and really weighting success more towards that. So, yeah, for instance, in our game, you can sort of drive supplies around. Most of the game, drop supplies off, people can build infrastructure, you know, and as we know, all wars are fought by the people in the rear echelon, by the supply chain. It's the Red Bull Express, I think, was the famous
yes.
US supply chain with the GMC trucks. And so, I mean, also, I mean, it ties nicely into sort of where we think this will go. I wouldn't be shocked to see these systems expand. So you may end up, you know, delivering ammunition or driving supplies or giving ranges to the artillery and never even firing your weapon. You might use your binoculars to spot targets for the artillery. And so this is sort of the way that the genre is expanding as well, in so much as people really using sort of their gray matter instead of just sort of muscle and reflex and reaction, which I think is, you know, I think is really exciting. I mean, as you know, so few people in war actually proportionally fired their weapon in anger at the enemy. And so I think it's kind of interesting from a historical perspective to, it's certainly a far more realistic picture to show the people who actually had to deliver the ammo to the frontline troops. I can't remember what the stat was. I think it was something like 15% of frontline of troops made up the frontline.
It's different. It's different in every army. Yeah, 17-1 in the U.S. in the Second World War, I think it was. Wow. You got me thinking. It's funny though. You got me thinking of things I never thought about, which is, for example, that my generation probably—that's probably a good age. I'm 55. We're the first generation who ever grew up with video games, and so how do you write video games to intrigue 55-year-olds? You know, it's a whole different thing than anyone had to worry about in the old days when nobody over a certain age played computer games. So, well, fascinating future in the offing for the
exactly.
for the design for geriatric video game.
Well,
fun.
Well, you say that, but I mean that that's really what I'm thinking about. I mean, I think it could be. I don't want to say it too soon, but it could be a very bright future for people, you know, for I think, you know, you look at sort of elderly people and obviously isolation is tragic and is really difficult for elderly people. I mean, it's difficult for everyone and obviously even more so for elderly people. And I do wonder what... the experience of being an elderly person would be like if I was in constant communication with a group of friends.
A buddy of mine once said, we're never going to be the isolated older people in the rest home. We're going to have much more to do than people who just stared out the window all day. I don't know if that's true, but certainly with things like this, you could see that this doesn't have to be anything that you ever have to give up entirely, necessarily, if your health will let you do it.
Exactly.
Listen,
yeah.
Max, thank you so much for coming on the program. I wish you continued success with this. It's a heck of an achievement just to see visually what you're talking about here and certainly to work through all of the ins and outs of the questions we've been discussing here. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Dan. And I mean, just a huge, huge fan. So this is just a wonderful, wonderful chance and fantastic questions and a great chat. Thank you so much for having me on.
Anytime. Take care, buddy.
That was a fun trip sort of down wargaming memory lane for me. If you were interested, by the way, in Hell Let Loose, want to know more about it, you can go to hellletloose.com. And I said when we started the Hardcore History Addendum feed that we were going to be able to use it as a way to try to explore some more of these history-related tangents at times, or very sort of niche history. For example, I am going to do a boxing show someday. I'm going to do a punk rock show someday. And I realize that's not sort of an appeal to the entire audience, but I'm hoping that when we someday have an archive, I don't know how old I'll have to be given my release pace, but an archive of a bunch of Hardcore History Addendum shows, some will be crowd pleasers across the board, and others will be these ones where, you know, you probably would skip by, but a person who's really interested in that subject would be really jacked to have a conversation. You know, we always used to joke that there's no place in broadcasting for people who are interested in 1950s Spanish language science fiction comic books. But if somebody did a podcast or a show about that, you know how jacked they'd be to have something so narrowly targeted to their interests. So I kind of feel like I want to throw some of those shows into the addendum feed. In any case, if you want to stay on top of whenever we manage to get something out, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Hardcore History. And I hope to be talking to you all again soon. Stay safe, everyone.
Don't forget, you can buy and instantly download past episodes of classic Hardcore History right from the website. Go to dancarlin.com to get the shows.